Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, William AC2ZV, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and for our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. Maintains an archive of these pages. We'll also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just put your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. Of course, we're also available on our Echo link. Our node is designated KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and all of this information can be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and William, AC2ZV, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the TechNet or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. Now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, William, AC2ZV. Good evening, William.
Roy, great to hear from you. Anyway, I have a couple of questions in the can in case nobody comes up with any. So let's go and see if anybody's out there with any questions. TechNet.
Yes, indeed. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And if there's anyone out there with any questions or topics of a technical nature tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. It looks like it's going to be another quiet beginning for the technical net. Hopefully, as time goes on, people will remember that we're here and tune in and come up with a question. So, William, what kind of questions do you have for tonight?
I've been thinking a lot about ham radio, and I've been reading articles about how to get more people involved, and it seems that everybody wants to join the radio with the computer to get some of the computer savvy kids and like that more and more involved. So I'm thinking that maybe topics would be interesting, or computer topics like Python programming and things like that. But my first question comes basically about an invention that I made and how it could possibly ever be implemented, and I'd want to hear your comment about it. So I'll let it break and then I'll tell you. The invention is like a static eliminator. So there would be a radio that would be hooked into a computer that would have voice recognition software on there that would be able to recognize voices, you know, even in noisy conditions, and then have that convert into a text and have that run into a voice synthesis unit to come out, and then you could choose the voice, you know, like you can with Siri. So it seems like we've got a lot of those components sitting around in the cell phones already. And the first part is the whole voice recognition to text. And that seems to even be there in the cell phone, the messaging app. So I don't know how well it works with noise. But anyway, that's my idea. And I'm wondering if you heard anybody doing something like that.
No, unfortunately not. In the past, I have thought to myself, Because I have my Flex is capable of recording 8 different separate frequencies simultaneously, and I can record them, but wouldn't it be nice to dump them to a voice recognition program and get a transcription? And then you could just simple search. Also, I've thought, I had nothing better to think about, wouldn't it be nice to have some kind of a voice recognition software that particularly recognized words, but recognized characteristics and match them to different hams. So that I would have on my screen flashing up on the different frequencies, call signs of the guys talking at that time. So those are the things that I thought of. Big problem, as I see it, with your idea is that getting rid of the noise. That's a very difficult thing to do. There are digital signal processor algorithms and circuits. They do not do a very good job of it. And so the problem, as I would see it, is anything other than a full quieted FM signal, you would probably have distortion and QRM and QRN and all kinds of things screwing up the voice recognition beyond any kind of recognition that I can think of. So I think that's where the stumbling block is. The big problem is not the voice synthesis or the voice recognition. It's getting them all to work together and getting rid of all the background noise that, as far as I'm aware, will confuse any voice recognition software made presently.
Remember, when I was younger, I used to sit and listen to the radio with headphones, and it was really noisy, the signals. And then I would be able to very easily say the story that I was listening with the headphones to my younger siblings, and they would get to hear it without any noise. And so, you know, that was a fun way for me to, like, listen to the BB and entertain the kids at the same time. And it seems like our computers are almost that smart. If a child could do it, you'd think the computer would be able to do it.
Not necessarily. There are some things that are well suited for serial processing, standard computers. They do symbol manipulation very well, very fast. So they will be able to give you the square root of 383.5 much faster than either of us could do. But the amount of speech processing that goes on between our ears is incredibly sophisticated. And people don't kind of recognize that much activity is going on, except that usually if you have to listen to a noisy signal and make sense of it, you tend to get much more fatigued than if you're listening to some nice FM full quieting audio. So it does take an internal toll on your neural networks, but it's what we've been fine-tuned to do over billions of years. So we do that much, much better than any kind of computer algorithm at this buzz.
In a way, that would be ideal. I like your idea of being able to convert all those conversations to text streams, be able to have that as a searchable. That sounds cool. I don't know. It seems like there's software out there that could do it, but we don't have the code or powerful enough equipment to be able to pull that off.
Well, it's a matter of processing power. If you have Dragon is a submission, a piece of software, and you could theoretically tie it in the audio output of something with very little noise, like an FM repeater. The problem is that it's not 100% accurate. It works better if you train it for a particular voice. So every time there's another person on the repeater, it'll have to either learn that person's voice or make a lot of bad guesses. So it's much more suitable for individuals to transcribe stuff on computers. Dragon Natural Speaking even had a module for medical personnel, where it's particularly tuned up to use a lot of technical medical terms. But it would fall apart when you started to introduce just a few people talking, you know, one after the other, because none of these things are really generically designed to figure out everyone's. Each one tends to talk a little bit different. And you have people with heavy accents, and it would go crazy on that.
The thing about heavy accents and language starts to be very a lot more stress on this than true. So I don't don't know. I guess it's something for the next century, like 100 years from now.
Well, I mean, if you actually kind of think about things, when people are using digital voice technology, the whole problem with digital voice technology is you just do an analog signal, analog to digital conversion. The bitstream is so much data, you would have to take up a major portion of a band's bandwidth in order to push it all through. So the compression method that everyone uses is something called a voice encoder decoder. And that's a fascinating device. It is actually able to detect individual phonemes, the parts of speech, and render them as a digital code and then rebuild them back into someone's voice, which is why D-Star and Fusion and DMR have usually minor artifacts. It doesn't sound exactly like the person you're used to talking to because of that encoding, decoding. So I wonder if you could finagle the phoneme translation tables to shift them into sounding like different people's voices. I don't think anyone's really bothered to try that. But there's all kinds of technology, and eventually maybe it'll be possible for computers to simply pick up anyone's language, transcribe it, and throw it into a file and recognize the different aspects of each as it trains itself with decoding their call sign information as well. So, you know, maybe 15, maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years. You never know how fast technology is going to advance. But right now, as far as I'm aware, unless you know there's something in the NSA's basement that costs millions of dollars, I don't know of any piece of equipment that can actually accomplish that reasonably well.
One of the miracles of radio communication is that somehow everybody can understand it if it goes through. So any language can go through the radio and still work out on the other end, pretty much. And if it's like a good connection, it doesn't matter what language is, the radio doesn't need to really understand anything that anybody's saying. It would do any language. So the idea of then having a translator that would work into a specific language would be a lot very narrow segment of the capability of what radio does.
Well, yeah, now you're adding another layer to it. Real-time translate, Biffy, if you ever try it with Google, if you ever plug in a phrase and then plug the phrase back in and have it translated back into English, you notice that a lot of times it loses a whole lot in the translation. So translation algorithms are problematic as well these days. But yeah, that would be a nice little feature. Every so often I'll go on 10 meters and there'll be guys talking in Spanish, which I forget my Spanish, so I don't know what they're saying. It would be nice to kind of hit a button and have a universal translator translate it into standard English for me to understand. But again, all those things are brave new worldish. They might be possible someday. You never know how electronics and computer electronics are going to advance. I certainly wouldn't guess that thumb drives would be able to hold terabytes of data. I come from the age of floppy disks that had 1.2 gigabytes, and before that there were lower density. There were a quarter that had something like 700 or 800 kilobytes. So you never know what the future will bring.
I've seen advertisements for those translator boxes that basically do a phrase translation. So if you say something, it will convert it into Spanish and say that out. So I would think ham radio might be suited for that if the receive side could work. You could see the transmit side could possibly work like that, but whether or not it would work with the receive, just noise, I think you're right. It would be too much for the machine to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as big a problem on FM with full quieting, but when you start to go into HF and you're dealing with sideband and even amplitude modulation, there's a lot of noise on the bands, and our brains are able to clear most of them, but some people can't even do that. I mean, I've experienced times on the Weimark Technical Net where a guy is coming into the repeater with far less than full quieting. And they're dropping out every so often, and because I tend to know them and what they talk about, I could fill in gaps. And some of the newer guys in the hobby were sort of amazed in the chat room that I was able to understand what the other person was trying to get across. So, you know, if we had a higher fidelity system, you would have much probably more experimental software for these things. But since the overwhelming majority of transmissions are kind of noisy and difficult for computers to unscramble, I think it's going to take a while before someone invents some kind of wondrous new digital sound processing algorithms to extract noise from transmission.
And even in your last transmission, there was this stray tone that came on about many deeps down below you. It was going wah bah 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 wah bah 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 like that. I don't know. It's probably some other distant signal coming in. But you contend with lots of interference in radio.
Yeah, and some people consider it a challenge. There's a member of our club that, as far as I'm aware, he hasn't really used the radio in at least 10 years. The last time I talked to him, which was a few years ago, he subscribed to a internet service that basically did voice over internet protocol. Because it was aimed towards amateur radio operators, you could choose to have them inject simulated static and interference on the audio signal so that you could sort of play amateur radio on the internet. I'm not quite sure the point of that would be, because if I had a switch to turn off all the background noise on the radio itself, I would push that button in a second.
With you on that, do you know that there's any, tone control circuits or anything that people normally do that would be a high-frequency cutoff or some kind of comb filter? Or is there something standard that is available for ham radio as an add-on box to transceivers to cut down on the noise?
Oh yeah, you can buy Bob Heil Sound manufactures, I believe, an equalizer. So you can tweak the sound curve and try and remove noisy portions. You know, if the high end has interference, you could try and remove it that way. There's a company BH something. Yeah, it's BH and their letter that sells digital sound processors that are external to the radio. You feed the audio signal from your radio into this device, and there are different noise reduction things. A lot of modern radios have their own DSP, digital sound processors, that have algorithms that they've designed to lessen the extent of different types of noise. And, you know, each brand and each model has slightly different algorithms. Some work a little bit better than others. None of them are perfect by far. My Flex has a couple of noise blankers and noise reducing algorithms and traffic equalizers. And in addition, if I have interference at a particular portion of the bandwidth that I'm receiving, I can narrow the filter so that instead of receiving, a 3 kilocycle signal, I can chop it off a little bit on the high end or low end and narrow it. The audio doesn't sound as good, but if there's a lot of interference that tends to be on the high or the low, I can cut that away. So there's a lot of different options. Nothing is a standard thing, though. Every radio has its own feature set, and more modern radios have a lot more capability than older ones. I think I haven't seen a modern radio without some form of digital signal processing.
ICOM radios, like the 7100 everybody's talking about, those have DSP algorithms in them for noise reduction?
Yeah, they have a noise blanker, they have a noise reduction, they have a notch, they have a few. It's not quite as flexible as my Flex radios, but, there's a difference in the price between the two. But, yeah, even, the 7100 offers all of those to varying degrees. Again, if you happen to have just noise at a very narrow portion of the band you're operating on and you can line up the notch filter correctly, you could null out that noise. A lot of noise, though, is not that at small range of frequencies. It tends to be more random and tends to move about. So you use different algorithms for different purposes.
That because noise seems to have a mind of its own. Let's see if anybody else is out there for the TechNet. See if anybody wants to join in.
Good idea. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. We start at 9 o'clock, and we go on until people run out of questions. So if anyone out there has any questions or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Roy, this is Bob, KE2NVB. I got back a little sooner than I thought, about 10 minutes ago. Still just a little too late to be there to start the net. If I'm here, I should be cooking a late dinner, but I'll be listening and maybe I'll chime in. So back to you.
Okay, very good, Bob. Glad to have you aboard. Fix your dinner and don't rush on my account. Once again, this is AC2GS, Roy here with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any technical questions tonight's TechNet, please hit that push-talk button, get your first name and your call sign. Oh, well, another quiet night in Brooklyn. William, next Wednesday, we're going to have our general meeting. Do you still want to do an Aries report, as you mentioned at the last meeting?
I don't mind doing it. There really isn't that much going on. I mean, Simon sends out his letters, and pretty much that's all the news I can keep up with. But it'd be nice to just mention it, and if there's any interest in the group, it'd probably be a 10-second segment. Maybe somebody would have something else to say.
Okay, very good. I'll put it on the agenda. Just wanted to double-check with you.
With a little bit of something, but I'm not exactly sure what that's going to be, but I'll have it ready by then.
Okay, very good. Well, I guess there's still no one around yet. Maybe they'll come later. So if you have any other questions, William, feel free.
About programming in Python?
A little bit. I have it on my list of things to do. I have Python programs. I have a Python interpreter. I see it, but I haven't really played too much with it. But it's certainly, it's one of those really important new programming languages. Most of the languages that I learned were compiled, C, C+. Although BASIC is an interpreted language, like Python is. And I knew how to do Rex, which was a scripting language. So I've used a couple of languages, and I'm interested in Python, but I haven't had an opportunity to really sit down with a good book and start from scratch with it.
I've done a number of projects, but it to me, there's something about it that I just can't seem to grasp that's in the very fundamentals of how the program is supposed to work. And I keep, and I haven't done it recently, but I've got new projects I'm thinking about. The idea of getting started is difficult because one of the things is there's mention statements or something that I don't know how to, and I don't really know when you say them or what they do. And so the whole thing of getting the computing environment preset for whatever it is you're trying to do is the part that I can't get. So what ends up happening is I find examples that run, and then I'll hack those examples until I get what I want out of it. But that's not really understanding what's going on.
Yeah, that's what I mean by you really need either a good internet-based source material or a proper book on Python and just start at the basics and work your way down. And most languages, programming languages, have a portion, I think you're alluding to, where you have to define the value of your variable because they can be different things. They can be binary, they could be floating points, they could be double floating points, they could be integers, and you have to explicitly describe what they are before you can use them. So I think that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. And then there's this whole trove of data that's in all these library files have to invoke at the beginning of some programming to something up. And like how those are documented, I don't understand. But you know, how when you the right code and you do it and it has this and that library and sum up for you, then you can write simple things on top of that that run. But where that comes from and how to use that, that's not very well explained as far as I can see.
Well, again, like many other languages, like that as well. There are standard libraries. The standard libraries, standard software sources will explain. The non-standard libraries that you do calls to, you have to seek out the guy who wrote them. He usually, to a better or worse degree, will document the calls to those particular libraries. You can't really go into the library and figure out what's going on unless it's very well documented. And a lot of software designers don't really well document their code. So you have to sort of rely on external reference material or standardized libraries.
MVP.
Yes, Bob.
I used to play with Python a little bit. I did more with Perl than I did Python. But there's an excellent book, the O'Reilly books, you know, with the animals on the cover. I think you can still get them. There's one just called Learning Python. That's an excellent book for starting. And also, I just typed Python libraries into Google and got the Python standard library, python.org, and then some other things. So you could probably poke around there about the libraries. There's is the import command. You probably know that already. Import this library or that library. And then use, I think it is, for the specific routine, specific, I guess they call them functions, Python. Anyway, this is my rusty memory of some Python. Back to Ned.
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, there's probably lots of information. It's just getting at it that's a problem. And the more standard libraries, the more sources, it would be easier to find. The problem is if you want to operate some esoteric device that one guy took the trouble of writing his own library for function calls, you have to find either his or some guy who dedicated more time on their hands to figure it out and document it properly so that you know exactly what the library calls are, what the functions are, what you have to, the types of values you have to plug into the function when you're calling it and what it does and all those little details. So standard libraries, you probably find hundreds if not thousands of discussions of what they do. The more device specific ones, if you need it because you're going to do something with say, a Raspberry Pi and you're going to put some kind of hat on the connections, have it do something fancy, and you're going to have to find that hat's library calls. So that's a little bit more difficult but not impossible. Find documentation on the internet.
I've done that with Raspberry Pis, and pretty much you go to Adafruit and you get the hat, and then they have the code, and they have a couple of examples about how to run the code in the hat, and then you get that, and you're able to program that and get it to work in the basic way, and then you're like on your own. You have to make it do something of your own, you know, and so then, you know, run your own motor, run your own robot, or whatever you have to do with it. So so those are pretty good sources. I still can do that, but it just get the whole structure. I thought, you know, that there's like a stage. Somehow the data pours into it, gets swirled around, and gets sorted out of. And it seems esoteric, but it, something like that's going on. And I can see parts of the process, but I don't really, not really visualize what's really happening. It goes from the start of the program to the output.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem, the benefit of importing libraries and such is that it saves you a lot of time from reinventing the wheel. Well, what it also unfortunately does is it sort of hides what's going on in the little black boxes those libraries contain. So the standard I/O library will do a standard input/output to a file or a device, and how it exactly is kind of moving the bits around, not quite obvious at the level of the program, because it's taking place in the function calls were included in the libraries that you don't see in the source code. You just see the label of the library. So I guess theoretically, if you had a lot of time and patience, you took apart the libraries and took a look what happened when you did the function calls, it would give you a little bit more sense of what's going on in the total program.
Really have anything to visualize when you're trying to evaluate these things. This is those of text, whereas if it's a machine, you can take it apart, you can see how it's made, or if it's electronic circuit, four chips, you know, you could see the components and how they were strung together. But when it's code, it's just like these bits of scattered here and there on the page. That's it.
Well, yeah, I mean, probably, I think I was fortunate in the first language I learned, BASIC. It didn't have external libraries. It just had a whole bunch of built-in functions, and you ran an interpreter, and you wrote something wrong, interpreter kind of spanked you, and you could follow the logic. I mean, you can't. It doesn't work like a mechanical device at all. You pretty much have to go through mathematical logic, you know, if, then, else, or, you know, arithmetic operations that are called under certain circumstances, or input-output of devices, working register bits on and off, and other such things. So it's more Boolean math than anything, I guess.
Thanks for your insight on that. Just sort of dabbling around, trying to figure out how to best use my time. And with all of the magnitude of information out there, it just becomes overwhelming. Think about trying to figure something out, and you get so much information to weed out.
Well, like I said earlier, probably the best approach, if you're willing to put in the time, is find a well-reviewed Python manual that assumes that you have little to no programming experience and is designed to kind of get you to not advanced levels, because I don't think a book can do that, but at least place past beginner. And so it'll give you hopefully a good foundation to build on specialty libraries of devices you happen to want to play with. But, you know, it's best to understand foundations and how everything goes together before you try and figure out how unusual libraries work.
I agree with you on there. One of the things I liked the most about the Raspberry Pi was the ability to use VNC with it and then be able to just have the Raspberry Pi to the side and then bring that up on my main computer screen and use my standard keyboard and mouse to navigate around through the various menus and things like that. And I found that to be a lot of fun and a great way to get to learn the Raspberry Pi without having to deal with the operating system of just the OS itself. I could have open Notepad on my computer and a window into the Raspberry Pi and cut and paste things out of my text document out of in and out of my test code stuff. And so, you know, that's fun. But learning how to do all that, it was a whole lot of just getting the foundation started to use the equipment at all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a different environment entirely. And using VNC isn't that difficult. Also, you may want to get used to using PuTTY. That's a terminal emulator. It runs on Apple, it runs on Windows, and you can open a terminal emulator to your Raspberry Pi and to play around with the command line interface aspects of Linux.
Okay, but for the Pi itself, since it has a graphic interface, I like just opening the window on the desktop of the Raspberry Pi, because a lot of times you have to interface between the CLI and the Python at the same time to get the full desired effect of what's going on in terms of finding the file and running it and things like that. So but I definitely, I've used PuTTY before, and but I don't really like using it. I prefer using the desktop and working with a live test code.
Okay, it's just as, even though they have somewhat grudgingly built a graphic user interface in Linux, it's capable of a lot of things using the command line interface. as far as I know, is very difficult to kind of translate into the graphic user interface. I mean, when you're updating files, you do the standard sudo, you know, update, upgrade, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Hands in the command line interface. So that aspect of Linux is far more powerful than the Windows implementation of Linux-based commands.
Do you know that if there is a dictionary of that CLI interface? Because you have to know a lot of stuff to be able to write this stuff down. Like, typically what I have to do that is to use the manual commands and write MAN on the command and then read all the stuff about the various variables and then have that available as a side reference. But I have to pick it out of the code each time I'm trying to use it. I've never really found a book that is that helpful. Or on an online source that's helpful, it doesn't like full of advertising. I'm always looking for better resources.
AC2GS. It's a problem. I've had to hunt and peck to get the proper commands. The problem with Linux is that the command line is so dense and obscure, yet powerful, that you can sort of tell the difference between a guy who has some recognition of Linux and one of these Linux wizards who can type a string of nonsensical commands with flags and all kinds of delimiters. It's just a matter, unfortunately, of Googling around and finding a bunch of sites that give you more information than advertisements. Even books. I'm not even aware of a book you could just open up and it has a list of every single command and you know, the options of it. There might be one, it's just I've never seen them, because it'd probably take up a very, very thick book just for that alone.
Probably does, and it's not that useful, because if you have a command line structure that says do this, and then you this sign and do that, or dash this, or dash that, you can have so many different variables just with different dashes after the main command that if you were to put checkboxes on a window, you have to have pages and pages of checkboxes to wade through to turn these things on and off. So it definitely, I can see where CLI is a benefit in some cases, but bridging that gap is difficult. And I do that sometimes with Terminal, which is similar, but it too has its own cadence.
Yeah, Linux is a great operating system, and I know people who only use Linux. I don't know. It has limitations that would probably drive me crazy after a while. I have them on my Raspberry Pis. I have two Raspberry Pis. I have a 4B and I have a 400, and they both have a raspberry flavored Linux OS on them. And I play around with it. I have one that's operating as a speedometer for my internet speed. I can pull up a web page that it's generating, see what the average up and down times are, and what the latency ping rate is. Nice little things like that.
Two Ethernet ports on this device so that all the traffic goes through it, or is it running off of a port that's just talking about all the traffic that goes through your switch?
What it does is it's a single Ethernet port. It simply runs a speed test at regular intervals and records the information graphically.
I see. That's simpler than I thought. Okay. Yeah. That seems interesting. And then you can call that up on a separate screen, either or VNC in a little window on your main screen if you want, that kind of thing.
It's a generally available website, so it sets up its own little web-based output. So I just any browser on my internal net in my house, I call up, and it's readily available.
Pretty cool resource. So then you can look at what the response has been throughout the entire time of day. Do you get an idea of how much traffic is going in and out of your network as well as the response time?
No, not through this, because it's not really sniffing my side of the internet connection. I do have other pieces of software that give me the amount of I/O that's taking place on my different computers. I have three computers. One of them is downloading about 2 megabytes per second, uploading about 300 kilobytes per second. Another one is doing less downloading, about 1 megabyte per second, and uploading 9 kilobytes. And a third that's downloading about 2 megabytes and uploading about 13 kilobytes. So the computer that I'm using right now to do the Echolink and all the other things, that's the thing that's sending a lot more data than the other two computers that are quietly sitting there in little.
2ZV. Yeah, but I guess your service provider is providing you a lot more bandwidth than that, even if the computers aren't actually using that much, right?
Yeah, basically I have 50 megabits per second download and 70 megabits per second upload.
50 down and 70 up? That's unusual.
Well, not particularly. Asynchronous is very common, and I guess because most people aren't uploading a lot of stuff, almost everyone tends to download significantly more. When they're distributing it in the central office, it works out that the upload capability is better than the download. I'm using Fios, and Fios is capable of much faster speeds. I think they offer some people a gigabit per second.
At the TV station, I had Fios, and, you know, we could buy whatever circuit speed we wanted, and it was just a matter of how much money you could management pay. But if you have guaranteed 75-75 or 150-150, a symmetrical bandwidth package, you know, that's a few hundred dollars a month, and we're running the whole TV station on it. So it seems like your arrangements are pretty good. It must be a household package. I can't wait, because Time Warner is... The uplink is so slow, whereas they give you high downlink but very slow uplink.
Oh, that's a shame. I haven't had any particular problems with Fios. Every so often, every few years, I need to call them at the central office to do a reboot because things kind of lock up. But those are few and far between. I have consistently decent speeds. I don't need gigabit speeds. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm watching multiple 4K Netflix videos or something. So, you know, it would be nice to have a little bit more, but at this point, I'm not really willing to pay anything extra for excess speeds.
Certainly, if you don't use it, why pay for it? Certainly true. Let's see if anybody is out there for this TechNet. I actually want to get along to supper myself after 10 soon. Let's see if anybody's out there. Maybe we'll do the puzzle.
Okay, very good. Good idea. This is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the 2nd and 4th Wednesdays of every month at 9 p.m. If you have any questions of a technical nature, this is a good time to ask them. Just hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name, and your call sign.
Control.
Yes, I think that's Max. Yes, the person who called Control, who I think might be Max, please respond.
That's Max, KG2VA. I just was going to say, so instead of thinking about on a programming piece, Python, whatever else, language, Java, C, whatever it is, less about getting a book unless you just want to go through like material, and start building and then looking up what you want to do. Same thing with Linux, CLI, interface, command line interface is just basically what are you trying to do, and if you run it, get stumped by it, Google is your best friend. It's a giant book of everything, so you just put it in. Usually there's a couple of websites that tend to have a bunch of people asking the same questions. You just go and read through a thread. Usually there's a one or two or three good answers. You try it out. If it works, you continue on and kind of hack away at it a little bit. I've done both book methods, and this kind of just go and try it. Go and try it is a lot more fun.
Okay, I could understand that. I think it ultimately, it depends on where you, if you had at least some experience with the language, then just kind of jumping in and trying to make things work be fun. If you don't have really that much experience with the language at all, I think that's a case to be made for a well-structured book to at least give you the foundations. You know, after you go through the first three, four chapters, if you feel confident, you can go off and try the other approach of just kind of Googling things and taking other people's code and moving stuff around and figuring out what happens when you change things.
Fair enough. On the structured piece, I've actually had really good luck with online video tutorials. There's actually classes from Udemy and other places as well that offer either very cheap or free online courses put together relatively well with step-by-step instructions, coursework, forums. It's kind of like the book except come to life. It's book plus. So I highly recommend those, and also gives you a nice paced environment where with a book you can put away and forget about it, but with that you kind of want to keep coming back to it because it's like, you completed 5 out of 6 classes for this week kind of thing. A little bit gamification, but hell yeah, had a good time with Udemy, for example, that's one of them.
Ah, very good. Yeah, I unfortunately that doesn't really work well with me. When I got my Anytone 878, I got it at I'm forgetting the place. They're very big in selling these things, and they have their own little, they call it university, which is basically a whole bunch of videos. And I listened to the first 10 videos. There's got to be 70 videos, and once every 2-3 weeks they still send me email that say, well, you've only finished many of all the videos we have available. Maybe you should go back and check them, and maybe you should buy another radio by us.
Bridgecom, I got my 7 8 7 8 from them as well, and they do come back with like a weekly reminder. You've completed 10% of your class. Yeah, that's true. But that I wouldn't call that like a fully immersive environment. But yeah, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what it amounted to is I figured out everything I needed to with the 878, and so I haven't gone back there. Who knows? Eventually I might. But there's a lot of great sites on the internet, and it depends upon the way you like to learn. Some people really like to do it through a book. Other people like videos. Other people like websites. There was a time when I was doing C coding that I was grabbing people's source code and ripping it apart and putting it back together and getting it to do all kinds of weird ways. So, I bought C and C++ books after I learned how to program already, just as a reference material. There's so many different ways of learning how to pick up stuff. It's easier when you're younger, I find, personally, unfortunately.
And you guys doubled up a little bit, but it's www.udemy.com. Man, I should really learn my phonetic alphabet. It's like Academy, but with a udemy.com. Whatever works. The great thing about right now is that you can have a book, you can go online and have a video course, you can take a real course at a university, you can listen to a podcast, or just research. There's so many ways to learn. It's actually pretty amazing.
Yes, indeed. We live in a golden age. When I was growing up, thankfully, I had a library a couple of blocks away. But if you needed to find out something, you hit the libraries. When I was doing my residency in Brookdale Hospital, I discovered that what drunks do in the night when they have a question or a disagreement, they will call up emergency rooms to get the answer to medical questions that they're disputing in the bar. So nowadays, I guess there's far less of those phone calls to emergency rooms, and people just open up their phones and Google the information. Okay, let's go to our puzzle for tonight. Let's see. It is a simple one. The question is as follows. What electronic devices have drains, gates, and sources? You have the choice of 4 different devices. Choice A is a triode vacuum tube. Choice B is a full wave rectifier. Choice C is a varicap diode. And choice D is a field effect transistor. So which of those electronic devices have a drain, gate, and source?
82 NVB.
Yes, Bob.
I'm a little rusty in all those terms, but I'm going to go with field effect transistors. But if it's not field effect transistors, then I think it's triode vacuum tube as my second choice, if I'm not allowed a second choice. But those are my answers. Back to Ned.
Okay, well, you got it right the first time. A triode vacuum has a plate, a cathode, and a grid. And for references, the full-wave rectifier has two inputs for AC and a positive and negative DC output. Varicap is a variable capacitor diode. It has an anode and a cathode. So you are quite right. It's a field effects transistor.
My memory is not so bad after all. It's a couple years since I took the test.
Yes, indeed. It's an oldie but a goodie. Field effects transistors are fascinating devices as opposed to bipolar transistors, you know, the old NP and NPN. They're very much like vacuum tubes, whereas bipolar transistors are current controlled. Field effects are voltage controlled in the same way that that vacuum tubes. They also have higher impedances than bipolar transistors. So very useful devices. You're using them a lot for a lot of different things. Your computer is filled to the rafters with field effects transistors in those large integrated chips.
I got one little question about that. Are the field effect transistors a newer technology than the bipolar transistors? Back to you.
Yes, they're slightly newer. It's not like they were just invented 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. Bipolars came out in the 50s, and I think MOSFETs, metal oxide surface field effects transistors, were perfected in the late 50s, early 60s.
So a difference of well under 10 years, maybe more like 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, both of them have been tweaked and adjusted through the years. I think they've kind of done a lot more interesting stuff with field effects transistors than they have done with bipolar transistors, using different substrates, bandpass, all kinds of different little gimmicks to make them do rather amazing things. They're the type of transistor used in modern-day solid-state linear amplifiers, LDMOSs, which is a laterally, I forget what the LD stands for, but lateral devices. They're long strings of field effects transistors, effectively. So they're doing really interesting things with the field effects transistors. I haven't heard them really doing too many tweaks on bipolars last in 20 years. Field effects transistors, they're using different substrates, which are allowing them to pack a lot more watts into power USB power sources that used to be these enormous things are shrunk down the size of a pack of cigarettes, and it can manage to throw 150 watts of electricity through the USB connectors into laptops and such, using this modern technology of field effects.
So a couple of questions. Is there anything, any advantage to a bipolar, or maybe the bipolar is cheaper? And I'm guessing that the old transistor radios that we had as kids, meaning like me and Roy who were around in the 60s with a little transistor radio, that was probably a bipolar transistor. Back to you.
Yeah, bipolars tend to be cheaper. They're easier to work with. Electrostatic charge can blow out the metal oxide surface part of the field effects transistor, where bipolars are a heck of a lot more durable.
So obviously bipolars in certain situations, they're the better choice just because they can take more, I guess, abuse or surges of electricity or stuff like that. Back to you.
Yeah, a lot of things can be used with you know, they put a PNP next to an NPN. They have a Darlington amplifier. That's a quick, easy amplification circuit, and it's not sensitive to static discharges. For high power, high wattage amplification purposes, that's where you tend to see a lot more field effect transistors being used.
Technically, a computer chip, like thousands or I guess millions of tiny transistors? Are those one of those types? Probably field effect, or is it something totally different?
I think for the most part they're field effects transistors.
Fascinating. You know, for the license exams, you know, we had to learn those, like, names of the gate and the source and the... But I don't think they had too much about, well, what's this one for, this type of transistor used for, and what's that one used for? At least I don't remember that. Back to you.
AC2GS. No, that's not the purpose of the exam. They just want you to have a familiarity. They're not expecting anyone to be an electrical engineer. In the old days, in the 40s and 30s, I still remember I used to listen to Gene Shepard on the radio, and he would tell the story in the 30s when he went for his exam. And those times, it was not a open question. It was multiple choice. Basically, they gave him a piece of paper and a pen, and they said, draw a Colpitts oscillator, include the value for the components.
Yeah, it seems like it gets easier and easier to get these licenses. I mean, I know I came up when it was much, not having to learn Morse code and all that. It seems like much easier than the people that had to go through all that. And what you're saying about the 30s sounds like they had to know even a whole lot more.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, there was less knowledge about electronics back then than there is now. But those were the days when a lot of people built their own stuff, or they built it for their friend. There wasn't much in the way of manufacturing of companies doing it. So these guys could kind of take apart back together their equipment. But it was far simpler equipment then, too. I mean, the old-timers would have gone cross-eyed if they saw what kind of little pea-size devices we have soldered into the PC boards of our equipment. So, you know, it's a different world. A lot of people just aren't interested enough in the hobby to go that deep on things. They did. They would just get a degree in electrical engineering and do that type of a job. I think everyone involved in the hobby sort of knows that the exams aren't meant to kind of test your mental fortitude of electrical engineering. They're just there to make sure that you didn't kind of drink through a couple of six-packs the night before the exam, which a couple of guys who came to one of our VE exams actually attempted to.
Funny, I heard that story. I heard it from you. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I wouldn't have. I'd probably just be the novice or something. But yeah, there was like people can't work on build the radios, modern radios, not anymore. I mean, people can't work on their own cars the way they used to. They can still to some extent, but some of this stuff, you know, you can't do it. You gotta have a computer thing that's cost $100,000 or whatever, certain things or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there are actually guys out there that build stuff. They're not that many, but there are some out there, especially if you go down to 75 meters, especially the AM guys. There seems to be a dichotomy among AM guys. Half of them seem to have rebuilt old cast transmitters. The other half are working on these Class H digital amplification circuits, their AM transmitters. And microwave as well. There's a lot of engineering work and design and building their own stuff on the microwaves. But that's just a very thin slice at the top band and the low band. Most people in the middle just order their stuff with a credit card, plug it in, turn it on, and chat.
Hey, I think that's what it is, build old technology. I guess the last thing is antennas. People can still build their own antennas. And I guess Dick K2RW was a microwave guy. He used to probably build stuff, I imagine. Back to you.
Yeah, he actually had a design for a UHF linear amplifier. I got a book from England which kind of wrote the history of linear amplifiers. And sure enough, on one page was a copy of the K2RIW linear amplifier. He also designed antennas and antenna arrays, so he had a couple of patents to him.
I think he's referenced in the handbook a couple of places, like some of his things.
Yeah, one of the most famous was that he borrowed some rather expensive equipment from the military manufacturing company he worked for, and he was able to receive Apollo signals. And he wrote a couple of articles about that and annoyed a couple of NASA people because they wanted privacy, apparently.
Yeah, I heard that story. I looked up one of those articles. I think it was just like, you know, this old one's going back to it, really, obviously, around that period of time, early 70s or 1970, whatever. And it was a microfilm thing. I mean, I tried to read some of it, but of course, it was all technical and way over my head, but it was interesting. And seeing this sort of grainy photo, I think of a young Dick there. And yeah, it was, yeah, cool. Very, very cool. I heard that story. Very funny about annoying the NASA guys.
Well, I could certainly understand. The thing, though, I mean, to me, it's beneficial to have that history because there are still guys out there who just vehemently refuse to believe that we went to the moon, that it was all some staged thing. And if we didn't go to the moon, they would have to send a radio satellite to the moon to fake the transmissions that Dick was able to receive, which is kind of absurd.
Maybe to pull that off might be harder than actually going to the moon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at that point, you might as well land there and pick up some rocks. But these guys are not particularly my idea of rational anyway. So, you know, if you tell them that you knew someone who actually listened to the transmissions, they would just tell you that he was lying or he was paid off or some such nonsense. You can't turn an insane person sane by talking with them. It doesn't quite work like that.
Again, it's just like that guy that once called in the one of when Dick was running the Climark technical net, and he was trying to convince everyone that the Earth was flat, and he could refute everything that someone else would say, that proving it's round. He'd have some talking point against that. It was just funny, and Dick just finally said, "We're going to move on. You have a minority opinion." I'd love to bring that one up. Back to you.
Yeah, that's Mark. Mark is a character. Haven't heard him in about a year, year and a half. Used to work at a fixture store. He used to tell people in the middle of the night on Limark's repeater that the East Coast was going to be flooded. And the rationale for him, because he believed in every single weird theory, he believed in Planet X. So he thought there was another planet that was hiding behind the sun, the same orbital distance we are, that was hitting us with beams or gravity, and it was going to drown the East Coast by raising the tidal forces. How you could have a flat Earth and Planet X, I never was able to quite figure out, because they seemed to be contradictory to each other. That's the beauty of a guy with severe paranoia. He believed every single conspiracy theory that he ever heard.
It's sort of like a sheet of paper orbiting around a basketball or something. Or maybe the sun is flat, too. I don't know. Thank you.
Supposedly, they sort of believe in Genesis's concept of the world, that the Earth is flat with a dome above it, and the moon and the sun are below the dome, above the dome, and on the dome are the little lights that the stars are. And then above the dome is a lot of water. So every so often, God would open the windows of the dome, and that's how it rained. So that's their image. Their image is a flat Earth with a transparent dome and a mountain of ice surrounding the entire thing, which they think is Antarctica.
So they think Antarctica's above this whole dome of stars? Because my dad went to Antarctica twice when I was a little kid. He was in the Navy on a ship. Bringing supplies to the scientists.
Yeah, see, these guys would say that your father was in on it as well, because they have this whole nonsense that no one's allowed in Antarctica. So that's why the rule is that you can't go there, because if you went there, you notice that it's just a bunch of mountains and it goes on forever and ever and ever, and you can circumnavigate the world next to the mountains of ice at the edge of the world. Quite crazy they are.
Slides and movies of the place.
Well, they'd say it was mocked up. William, you want to say something?
It's true that if you could pretend the world is totally flat and you could circumnavigate the world by driving around the outside of Antarctica, so that's sort of true. So they kind of bent the whole sphere of the Earth into a flat thing and then get rid of the edges. They did that and said you can't go over the mountain. But what happens if you go over the mountain, you see the hole in the middle of Antarctica where the UFOs go in and out. That's why you can't go down there.
Well, but that's another conspiracy which Mark also believed in, which is the Hollow Earth conspiracy. And as far as I've been able to figure out, they thought that both Antarctica and sometimes some people thought the North Pole had an opening. And you could go in through the opening and there was an advanced civilization with nuclear weapons. And every so often there were people who thought that the creatures living in the hollow of the Earth took out a Tesla weapon and pointed it at the World Trade Center. That was another way of kind of merging two conspiracy theories together. So yeah, there's the Hollow Earth, the Flat Earth, and Planet X, which is our evil twin killing us on the other side of the sun.
Well, Roy, thanks a lot for clearing all that up. I think I'm going to go have supper. Thanks a lot. I enjoy being the co-host. Maybe somebody else out there has got something to chat about, but I think I'm going to check out if that's okay with you.
Perfectly fine, William. Thank you for being co-host with me tonight, and have a good dinner.
73, Roy. Nice to hear from you, Bob and Max. Talk to you again soon. Bye.
Okay, Oak, once again, this is AC2GS Roy here with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. If anyone has any questions or comments before we call it a night, please hit that push-talk button, give me your call sign and your first name.
This is KG2VEA, Max. I thoroughly enjoyed the last conversation. As crazy as it will be, it is kind of fun as a, you know, thought experiment. What if, you know, Earth was flat? Crazy as it is, pretty funny, though. Definitely made my evening. Thank you.
You're welcome, Max. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of weird theories out there. I mean, if you're interested in bizarre theories, there's something called the electric universe. One of the things about Flat Earth is they can't quite figure out how to fit gravity into it all. They do away with gravity completely, and in gravity's place, you have two choices. You either have the Earth traveling at an accelerated speed, and that's giving you the force of gravity, or else you have to make up this weird theory about buoyancy, trying to not keep in mind that buoyancy is related to gravity. So there's another theory that has nothing to do with the Earth. It's called the electric universe. These guys want to believe that there's no such thing as gravity either. They think that electromagnetism is the force that keeps everything together and working, and that a plasma device run on electrical currents that run through the universe. So if you have nothing better to do someday, look up the electric universe.
Even more bizarre. I did not even know someone's theory existed. That's fascinating. That's awesome. Well, I'm going to put a night, I will see you guys in 2 weeks.
Okay, very good, Max. Thanks for coming. Thanks for participating. I will ask one more time if there's anyone else with any closing comments before I close the net. Now's your time. Okay, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be March 2nd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me for the required link. You have to ID yourself. It can't be anonymous. But as long as you tell me who you really are, via link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Now, it used to be linked up to our repeater. Presently, it doesn't seem to be. It's in its own Wires X room. If you get to Wires X or a gateway to a Wires X room, FusionNet. You could use that, and eventually, I hope, it will be reconnected to our repeater. We offer an audio stream of our repeater on the internet, as well as all audio transmissions, including 10-meter net on Sunday morning. That's available by typing into your browser, stream.kc2rc.com. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams in our club, and as I've mentioned before, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of the Technical Net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this Technical Net, amateur radio news, original articles, technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Free Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. Try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up, but we'll be back March 9th to do it all over again, and you're welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially William, AC2BZ. Without you guys, I would just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2G. Yes, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Safe, be well, and we'll talk again.
Great fun. I'm glad I got back for most of it. Thank you, William, for outing for me. I'll see you at the meeting and in 2 weeks. 73s.
Everyone, AG2BA, Max.